Welcome back to the Popular Mechanics Show. I'm your host, Ben Chertoff. In this special edition of the Popular Mechanics Show, we're going to tackle the growing collection of 9/11 conspiracy theories. It's been almost 5 years since the September 11th attacks on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon, yet in that time, a growing chorus of conspiracy theorists has developed an alternative narrative for the events of that morning, one that blames the U.S. government for the terrorist attacks. Not only did the government fail to act to stop 9/11, say conspiracy theorists, but the government actually carried out the attacks themselves. These theories are no longer relegated to the outer fringes of the internet. One of the most popular viral videos of the past year is the movie Loose Change, a homemade collection of 9/11 conspiracy theories that makes up with popularity for what it lacks in cohesive narrative. While Loose Change is probably the most visible conspiracy weaving phenomenon, it represents many thousands of web pages devoted to the theory that the 9/11 attacks were staged to create a public justification for the war in Iraq, or to help foster the rise of a police state, or, as one conspiracy site puts it, to provide the justification to destroy, quote, anti-Israeli Saudi power structure and place U.S. Zionist generals in control of Saudi Arabia, all as part of a master plan which would place essential control of the huge majority of Middle Eastern oil in the hands of the Israeli-controlled U.S. government, unquote. While they vary in motive, nearly all the conspiracy theories hold at their core a piece of physical evidence, a claim such as that jet fuel does not burn hot enough to melt steel, as in explosives brought down the towers, or that cell phones do not work at jet airliner altitudes. Well, in March of 2005, Popular Mechanics published a groundbreaking article that examined these claims in detail. I was one of the 9 reporters on that story, and in every case, with every claim, we found that the facts asserted by conspiracy theorists were misunderstood, misquoted, taken out of context, or simply lies. That story, now read by tens of millions of online readers, was the inspiration for the new book, Debunking 9/11 Myths, which greatly expands the original reporting and tackles new aspects of these conspiracy theories. Joining me to discuss this new project are the book's co-editors, Popular Mechanics executive editor David Dunbar, who is in the studio with us today, and Popular Mechanics contributing editor Brad Reagan, who's joining us by the phone. Also with us is Popular Mechanics editor-in-chief Jim Meggs, and a true expert when it comes to building fires, former deputy fire chief of the New York City Fire Department, and the co-author of the book The Collapse of Burning Buildings, Vincent Dunn. We'll examine these myths in detail, and we'll walk step by step through an analysis of one of these conspiracy theory claims right now on the Popular Mechanics Show. Later on in the show, we're actually going to debunk one of these myths and actually go through a real analysis of it. But in general, what were the methods to come up with this? Especially since the conspiracy theorists will present what they say is a thoroughly researched point of view. How did we go about doing this?
Well, one thing that's fascinating about the whole conspiracy movement is how much it tries to look like really hardcore, serious scholarship. You know, you have footnotes and references. But if you track them down, a lot of them just go in circles. You know, One conspiracy book will footnote another conspiracy book, which footnotes another conspiracy book. You have to go pretty far before you come up with something that really resembles an actual fact. And what we did, both for the original article and for the book, was we looked for the concrete physical facts, the things that can really be checked. And things like, you know, at what temperature does steel begin to lose its strength? Or how big was the hole in the Pentagon? Do cell phones work in airplanes? Things like that. And those are things you can actually check. You know, it's not our job to check these various political claims, but we really focus on the kinds of things that Popular Mechanics has always had expertise in and look for answers on those. And what you really find is there's about 20 common facts that are referenced over and over again in these conspiracy theories. Beyond that, there aren't too many. It wasn't like we only took a sampling. These were virtually all of the major factual claims that you can see in these conspiracy theories, even though they're repeated thousands, maybe millions of times across the internet and in these various conspiracy books.
So do cell phones work on planes?
They certainly do. Well, and it's typical of the way conspiracy theories work, is they tend to ignore the vast body of data and just focus in on a narrow question, and to narrow down the whole discussion. It's a little tiny question. And then even there, you see that their facts are incorrect. But what's interesting is most of the calls weren't made from cell phones. They were made from seat-back air phones. That issue kind of gets sidestepped. But even on the point of cell phones, you know, it's not that hard to find out. You just call the engineers at cell phone companies and ask them.
Right. David, how many...
Ben.
Go ahead, Brad.
I was just going to expand on that point. What the conspiracy theorists do a lot is they compile a lot of information from second and third-hand sources, and then that gets passed along, and then by the time it's published in the format that most of us see it, it's seventh or eighth hand. And what we tried to do very much was go back to the original sources. If they quote somebody as saying something, or if they mention that someone is their source for X, that, say, for example, if they say a fireman said he heard what sounded like bombs going off in the World Trade Center, that person, and say, was that initial quote accurate? Were you quoted accurately? Did you see what they say you said, etc.? And almost without exception, we found that the conspiracy theorists were misusing information, and they had not checked it. And so one of the things we tried to do was go back to the original sources and do original reporting, which I think is extremely rare in the conspiracy world.
Hey, David, I don't know if you can quantify this exactly, but Brad is talking about going back to the experts. I know in the original story we had upwards of 300 experts who we talked to, we quoted, and were helped very much by around over 70. Can you quantify the amount of research that went into this? I know it's a lot, and it's probably a couple of months of your life.
Well, we had, for the magazine, I think we had a team of seven researcher, reporter, writers. And for the book, we had a team of four, including myself. And we went back to some of the sources we used in the magazine and got more information from them, more in-depth reporting, and then also talked to another whole batch of experts for the four new conspiracy theories that we brought to the book. And one thing, if I could add, about the cell phones, if there's any physical evidence for government agents imitating loved ones and passengers, we'd be happy to fact check that as well. But like so many of the conspiracy theories, there's no factual basis for this. It's a wild theory with nothing to back it up. But if someone confesses, if there are tapes, if there are transcripts, if there's anything that we could fact check, we'd certainly be happy to look into that.
Excellent. And of course, in just a moment, we're going to look into some of the specific myths. You can find the book, Debunking 9/11 Myths, at debunking911myths.com, which will take you to the blog about the book and a way for you to buy it yourself.
You're listening to a special edition of the Popular Mechanics Show. Our regular show returns next week. In the meantime, we welcome your comments about our podcast. Please send your thoughts to popularmechanics@hearst.com. That's popularmechanics@hearst.com. We'll walk you through a step-by-step analysis of one of these conspiracy theories coming up next on the Popular Mechanics Show.
So one of the most persistent conspiracy theories that come up, and I think this was one of the original inspirations for the original story, are these conspiracies dealing with the three World Trade Center buildings that collapsed on September 11th. They're focusing on the heat of the fuel that burned from the plane and the temperatures at which steel melts, and the idea that these don't match up and that steel can't possibly melt because of steel can't possibly melt at the temperature at which jet fuel burns, thereby showing that there had to have been detonation charges in the building. We looked at that fairly closely. I want to go through some of that now. We have with us Vincent Dunn, who is the former deputy fire chief in New York City in the New York City Fire Department and the author of The Collapse of Burning Buildings. So jet fuel burns hot, doesn't necessarily burn hot enough to melt steel so it drips down, but it doesn't necessarily have to damage a building, right?
The term melt is the problem. When you heat steel to 1,000 to 1,100 degrees Fahrenheit, the steel loses 50% of its load-bearing capability, and it will start to not support its load.
Mm-hmm.
Collapse of steel buildings usually occur when the steel reaches a temperature of 1,000 to 1,100 degrees Fahrenheit. Steel may not, it will not melt there, but it warps, it sags, it twists, it expands, and the support load is too great, and the building will collapse. Generally, mm-hmm. we feel that when the steel is 1,000 to 1,100 degrees, it loses 50% of the supporting load, and the structure starts to fail. It does not melt at 1,100 degrees, but it loses its load-bearing capability.
And how hot was were the fires from a kerosene fire in the buildings in the World Trade Center?
A normal fire in wood, paper, typical combustible material, is about 7 or 8,000 British thermal units per pound. A flammable liquid gives off 1,600 or more British thermal units per pound when it's consumed in fire. A flammable liquid fire is hotter than a normal fire in wood or paper. So there was certainly enough temperature in that burning World Trade Center building to weaken the steel. Also, steel, when steel fails and a building collapses, is not only the temperature of the steel in the fire, but how fast the steel fails and the load falls depends on the thickness of the steel. And the 60-foot unsupported bar joists of each floor was very thin steel. So the thickness or thinness affects how fast the steel will fail. The temperature, as we said, that was hotter than normal fire in the World Trade Center due to the flammable kerosene jet fuel. And the load that the steel is supporting determines how fast the steel will fail. And that was supporting a heavy load. You had 20 floors above coming down on it. And also the kind of protection. That's why we protect steel with fire retarding to keep the temperature from reaching 1,000 degrees. And we know there was a problem with the insulation fireproofing. It was scraped off by the airplane. Even before that, it was dropping off during the construction. So these four things determine how fast steel will fail.
So when you look at those photographs in our book of the exterior columns of the Twin Towers kind of pulling in, you can see that they're deformed inward. What's happening at that point?
They feel that the steel bar joists were sagging. And when they were losing strength, they were sagging and warping due to the heat of the fire. They were pulling in the frame tube construction. The 60-foot unsupported steel trusses were connected to the center core columns, and they were connected to the outer tube frame tubes, which were, in effect, a bearing wall. So when they sagged and they started to collapse, they pulled in the frame tube outer curtain wall.
And how is this different from a regular building? I know we talked about this beforehand, but the World Trade Center is a very unique building in that you've got these massive unsupported floors. Is there an easy way to describe that?
It was radically different construction from any high-rise building in New York City. To my knowledge, it was the only structure in New York City built that way. It was a center core column building with 60-foot unsupported steel bar joist truss and connected to outer tubular bearing walls. It was a bearing wall building. The steel floors were supported by the inner core columns and those outer frame tubes.
Right. So it's almost as if you have this, the core is standing in the middle, you've got the walls on the outside, and the floor is just kind of attached on one end on the outside and one end on the inside. And it's not like a typical building where you've got cross beams and bars going up like a big cage.
That was radically different construction, as I said. And it was the lightest weight building in New York City. Even Leslie Robinson, the engineer, said it was a leap to lightness, he called that building. To get to 100 stories, they had to reduce the weight of each floor. If you can reduce the thickness of the steel, you can build higher, because the steel weighs on the structure. So this was lightweight construction. Now, most buildings, high-rise buildings in New York City, in Manhattan, are skeleton steel structures. They are steel frameworks, steel grids that go up. Most structures in Manhattan have columns, steel columns, steel girders, and steel beams supporting the structure.
Right, that's what makes that
network
grid-like.
There were no girders in the World Trade Center. You had center core columns, and you had 60-foot unsupported truss floors with frame tube outside walls. Mm-hmm. The idea was to give as much open floor space, rentable open floor space as possible. They did not want steel columns coming up through the floor. Every foot is $25 or $50 per square foot. If you can eliminate 20 columns, you can rent more floor space. There were no girders and interior columns in that floor in the World Trade Center, as there are in most skeleton steel buildings in New York City.
And if I could just jump in, one thing that I think often gets overlooked on the conspiracy side, people focus on the fires, but they tend to overlook the damage the aircraft impact themselves did in terms of severing those, those tubular outer columns and doing some damage to the inner core. So the building, even before the fires, was already under extraordinary strain, had to redistribute those strains.
Yeah, World Trade Center 2, I believe it was 10 of almost 10 of those core columns were destroyed.
So in a situation where a building has some structural damage and then suffers a fire, how much worse does that make the situation of the fire?
Much worse. And the buildings did withstand the impact of those planes. The cause of that collapse in the NIST investigation was stated that the interior core columns started to fail and the floors failed because of the absence and the removal of that spray-on fire retarding on the steel floors. So those two causes, the interior columns were failing and the fluffy spray-on fire retarding on the steel was scraped off and is actually falling off. There's a new discovery about the spray-on vermiculite that we put on steel to protect it from a fire. We were always concerned with density, how thick the fluffy fire protection was, and we were always concerned with the consistency, how much of the steel was completely covered.
Mm-hmm.
Now they're talking about adhesion. They're finding that when you put this fluffy spray-on vermiculite volcanic rock to insulate the steel in a building and enclose it in a ceiling plenum, and you have air movement through that plenum over years, the air movement from the air conditioning system blows off the fluffy spray-on. Now when they put this fire-retarding insulation on the steel, they worry about consistency, the density, and now adhesion.
So the air conditioning in a building could be enough to blow this off, and then you think about planes hitting it.
Well, the problem with the insulation, we always knew. In 1970, when they were building the building, the chief of department, John O'Hagan at the time, he complained about the new spray-on fire retardant. Prior to the 1968 code, when you protected steel, it was a cement type of covering or a plasterboard, thick type of adhesion that would cover the steel. The new advance was this fluffy spray-on. You could spray it on with a gun. It was quicker to cover the steel away. But the fire service was always concerned, many times the steel wasn't prepared right. In the World Trade Center, you had primer coat on it. It should have been sent right to the steel direct without the primer coat. Second of all, when they mix the slurry, sometimes they don't mix it properly. Thirdly, when they give that job out, it's usually to a young, inexperienced laborer. and he does not cover the steel completely. Or if he does cover it completely, he does not put the proper thickness of the insulation on. And after he does that job, when the other tradesmen come in, electricians, air system people come in, and they start to do their work, they scrape it off. They don't realize the importance of the spray-on.
Right. And, of course, that primer coat I was reading last night, that decreased the adhesiveness of the spray-on foam by something like two-thirds. So it was very prone to falling off. I've got another point that comes up quite a bit in the conspiracy theories. This focuses on a comment made by Larry Silverstein in the PBS documentary America Rebuilds. This was in 2002. He was saying, in reference to the collapse of World Trade Center 7, which, of course, he was the primary leaseholder of the building then, he's recounting getting the word from the fire department that they were not sure if they could contain the fires in World Trade Center 7. Remember, this is 7 hours after the World Trade Center tower collapse. There hadn't been much attention paid to World Trade Center 7.
I remember getting a call from the fire department commander telling me that they were not sure they were going to be able to contain the fire. I said, you know, we've had such terrible loss of life. Maybe the smartest thing to do is pull it. And they made that decision to pull, and then we watched the building collapse.
That term, pull it, has fueled many conspiracy theories that accuse Larry Silverstein of ordering the demolition of World Trade Center 7. The concept that pull it refers to a controlled demolition, that it's a code word. Putting aside for a moment why he would want to destroy his own building that day and then admit to it, we spoke to a number of controlled demolition experts and companies, and none of them said that pull was even a word that you'd use in controlled demolition. But it is a phrase used by firefighters in a certain context. So what does Silverstein's comment mean if you're thinking about the context of talking to the FDNY?
Well, you know, you say pull out, you know, withdraw, back out, but Silverstein is not a firefighter. So he was using his terminology. That could be a World War II John Wayne term, pull it, pull out, pull out, pull the troops out. So I understand what he was talking about, and many chiefs were thinking the same thing. We should pull out of this fire. It looks like it's a losing proposition. So I would never consider that would be any type of conspiracy. It's ridiculous.
And in fact, that was a worry for a while, too, with World Trade Center 7, that it was a collapse possibility, right? I mean, this wasn't something new that suddenly, it wasn't unexpected.
The chief in Tower 1, Joe Callan, he ordered the firefighters out of that building 20 minutes before Tower 2 collapsed. So firefighters at the scene and fire commanders knew that building could collapse. Joe Callan was one.
World Trade Center 7 is a fairly unusual building. NIST found that the construction was unusual and that there was a lot more damage than people had previously thought. Brad, can you explain what exactly NIST has found and what they think were the modes of failure in World Trade Center 7?
Well, when the adjoining tower collapsed, it sent an enormous volume of dust and debris into World Trade Center 7 to a degree that was really unknown for a long time, and we were able to look at a couple of photographs that showed the damage to that. And what you could see was there was a large portion of the building that was basically scooped out. So just from that alone, the building had suffered enormous structural damage just from the debris of the falling towers. And then in addition to that, there were a number of fuel tanks throughout the building, and some of them attached to pressurized lines. So there were a number of fires burning throughout the building for hours the morning of September 11th that were literally being fed by fuel continuously. So those fires were burning out of control, and in combination with the structural damage, it just became too much. And David, you can maybe explain about the substation as well.
Well, it was built over a Con Ed substation, so there were unusually, and Mr. Dunn, correct me if I'm wrong on this, but the unusually wide floor expanse that would be supported by the columns, and so the effect was that if you remove the one column, or if that lost ability to carry load, it would start a kind of a chain reaction collapse. Is that more or less?
That's what we determined in the fire service. When they had the Con Ed plant with approximately 5 or 6 stories to build a 47-story building over it. They put a transfer steel truss beam over the top of the Con Ed structure. And they sent the columns of that building. When they came down, they went into the transfer steel truss and distributed the load to other columns on the outside to the foundation. And they felt that when the fire occurred, the transfer beam failed, and that contributed to the collapse. For example, in the Oklahoma City bombing, where 168 people were killed, in that building, that 9-story building, they had a transfer beam on the second floor, and the center columns in the Murrah building came down and were terminated in the transfer beam. The load was transmitted to the outer columns. The outer columns went from the roof to the foundation. When the blast occurred, the transfer beam on the second floor in the Murrah building collapsed, and that contributed and allowed the center columns to fail, and the entire front of that building collapsed. So it's better to have your columns go all the way down into the foundation. And where you have a transfer beam, if that transfer beam fails, the structure is seriously weakened.
And Brad, I know you had mentioned before that part of the building was scooped out. One of the reasons why it's not really been public information that the damage had happened and investigators hadn't seen that damage was because it was on the south side of the building, right? And that was
right.
It was certainly a difficult place to get a good vantage point to take a photo of that day. Where did these new photos come from?
Well, you're exactly right. It was on the south side of the building, which was almost totally obscured by the dust and the debris. And there are a couple of photos taken from the ground where you can make out a little bit that scoop damage. But the one definitive photo we found was from the New York Police Department. They had a helicopter overhead that was in perfect position, and it's available in the NIST report, which is online, and it really shows definitively the extent of the structural damage.
Well, one of the things when the towers collapsed and Building 7 was burning, the fire chief said nobody goes into Building 7. There was no firefighting. They removed the people from the building, so that was a free-burning fire for 7 hours. Fire service, we always managed to control the fire. But we did not send any firefighters in to do fire extinguishing. That was a factor. So it was 7 hours of free burning. The other thing, they had a diesel tank on an upper floor in there. I don't know, but that could have been a factor if the fire affected this diesel tank that was used for generating energy for the command post. But so the free-burning fire for 7 hours and the possibility of the diesel fuel leaking and burning in there were additional factors in addition to the destruction of the building by parts of the plane and by parts of the building collapse of Tower 1.
But certainly none of those factors point to explosives being used or that being the only explanation.
No one really feels that there were explosives or missiles sent into that building. But honestly, I have to say, when I first saw that structure fail, that thought occurred to me. However, when I went back and studied the construction of the building, the frame tube, outer bearing walls, the center core, columns, and 60-foot unsupported floor beams without any girders or columns, I then understood how those structures could fail within 10 to 12 seconds.
Yeah, one thing that I think has really driven a lot of this for a lot of people is none of us knew what it looks like when a 100-story building collapses. You know, we'd really only seen it in the movies. And we'd seen, of course, a lot of the big showcase demolitions. Some of the major companies have done a big Vegas hotels and that kind of thing. And a building that falls straight down, it looks pretty much the same whether it was professionally demolished or it's a chain reaction collapse.
Right.
They're not necessarily that different. And even in one case, a demolitions expert said in one case, the Van Romero quote that's in the book, he was quoted as saying that it looked like a professional demolition. Then later when he went back and studied it, he made it clear that he didn't believe that it really was a professional demolition.
In fact,
demolition.
He was misquoted as saying that, right?
And so he, you know, he's been very vocal that he doesn't think it's a demolition, but it was kind of a natural thing for anybody to think. I mean, the conspiracy people are indulging in a natural question, given that no one really knows what things are supposed to look like. And a lot of people are obsessing right now over the speed of the collapse. And I think some of this is actually driven by the idea that it didn't happen in slow motion.
Right.
You know, it was incredibly fast. But if you think about, as Vincent, you said, you know, 20 stories of weight above the impact site, you think once that failure begins and you have that enormous load striking the subsequent floors, how long does it take for them to fail? I mean, there's no real reason in physics that it shouldn't, that the subsequent failure shouldn't be almost immediate. And,
right.
And in fact, those buildings came down so quickly and so powerfully, I think it was a lesson to all of us that large, heavy structures, when they start to fail, it's an extremely intense event.
And of course, force is a function of mass and velocity together, so that all multiplies and creates a very powerful thing.
One thing in the NIST study that just came out, for the first time, they're recommending that building codes and building designers consider total progressive collapse. We have never considered that when analyzing the structure of a building. We always considered floor failure, partial failure, but now NIST recommends building codes and designers consider and evaluate their structures for progressive collapse for the first time since the World Trade Center failures.
Excellent. And I want to get into more of the why and what these investigations are going to change in a little bit. Once again, you're listening to the Popular Mechanics Show, a special edition focusing just on the new book from Popular Mechanics, Debunking 9/11 Myths, and that is, of course, available at Barnes & Noble and at bookstores everywhere and at debunking911myths.com. We'll be right back.
Can I begin, please?
A6, oh, my
God,
I'm
on the 83rd floor.
A6 what?
I'm on the 83rd floor.
A6 what?
A695.
A695? She at the World Trade Center. Someone having difficulty breathing on the 83rd floor. Okay, ma'am, how you doing?
Are they going to be able to get somebody up here?
Well, of course, ma'am. We're coming up for you.
Well, there's no one here yet, and the floor is completely engulfed. We're on the floor, and we can't breathe.
Okay.
And it's very, very, very hot.
Last week, New York City released the recordings of 1,600 emergency calls made on September 11th, 2001. That call was made by Melissa C. Doy, one of 3,000 people whose only mistake was showing up for work too early that morning. You're listening to a special edition of the Popular Mechanics Show. As always, we welcome your comments about our podcast. Please send your thoughts to popularmechanics@hearst.com. That's popularmechanics@hearst.com. One of the most fascinating claims of the conspiracy theorists is the idea that NORAD, or North American Aerospace Defense Command, which is the group that's assigned to defend U.S. and Canadian airspace, a holdover from the Cold War, that it should have been able to find and shoot down these hijacked planes before they hit their targets, and that it is preposterous that airplanes could slip through this defense network. And of course, in reality, it was a morning of confusion because you've got air traffic control who's got to contact the FAA, who's got to contact the Pentagon, who then contacts NORAD, who then contacts the specific subsector and then directs planes, which would have taken forever. And what's emerged since 9/11 is a picture of this confusion. And I have a clip. We have some clips that Vanity Fair released on their website last month, tapes of the actual NORAD transactions between air traffic control and NORAD. And I'm going to play one now. This is between Boston Center and Northeast Aerospace Defense Sector, which is up in New York. And they were in charge of, they would have been in charge of vectoring flights to New York City and to Washington.
Do you have any motion?
Is he inbound to JFK?
We don't know.
You don't know where he is at all?
He's being hijacked. The pilot's having a hard time talking to the... I mean, we don't know. We don't know where he's going. He's heading towards Kennedy. He's, like I said, he's like 35 miles north of Kennedy now at 367 knots.
Okay.
No idea where he's going.
If you could please give us a call and let us know, you know, any information, that would be great.
Okay. Right now, I guess we're trying to work on, I guess there's been some threats in the cockpit.
There's been what? I'm sorry.
We'll call you right back as soon as we know more info.
Thank you.
Okay.
Sure.
So you can see there's confusion about where these planes were going and what was going on. Hey, Brad Reagan, you studied a lot of this and helped put together our reporting on what happened with NORAD. What was the general thought that day? What were the capabilities of NORAD on the morning of September 11th?
Well, it's important to go back and think about this and pre-9/11 with pre-9/11 eyes. This was post-Cold War and obviously pre-9/11, so our military capabilities on that day were not what most people probably thought they were. There were only 14 fighter jets on alert in the entire continental U.S. and only 4 in the northeast sector, which was where the hijacks occurred. So really only 4 jets on alert at the time. And the NORAD defense structure was all pointed outward. It was a Cold War structure. It looked at threats coming in from the outside. So it really wasn't prepared for what happened on 9/11, which led to the confusion that you just heard. And the hijackers were very clever. They turned off the transponders on the planes after they took them over, which made it very difficult for the FAA and NORAD to track where those planes were in the air. They basically had to try to guess out of a series of blips on their screen which ones were the hijacked aircraft. So there were a number of procedural problems built in there, but I think one of the other things that people forget is how quickly things happened on that day. And I think about where I first was when I heard about the plane hitting the towers and to the time it took when, you know, the plane went down in Pennsylvania. It was about an hour and 40 minutes, and it all happened very quickly, and I think the military wishes it could have responded quicker, but there were a number of reasons that they were unable to.
And also, what would be the response be at that point, especially when the planes had just been hijacked? There was confusion about what the intentions were and what could be done to the planes. Hey, Brad, can you explain a little bit about what happened once the military was sure that there were hijackings going on? I mean, there was still confusion about what the rules of engagement were. Isn't that correct?
So there were 4 fighter jets that were scrambled on 9/11. And but when we say scrambled, that means the pilots rushed to their planes and got in the air, and they got into the airspace. But there's a difference between the plane scrambling and actually intercepting an aircraft. And in the decade before 9/11, there was only one other instance where American fighter planes intercepted a civilian aircraft, and that was when Payne Stewart's Learjet went off course because of decompression in the cabin. So it was a very unusual circumstance, and the only circumstance under which they could have actually acted was to have a direct order from the top of the military chain of command, which is the president and vice president. And that order was not actually issued till about 10 minutes after Flight 93 was down. So even if the fighter jets had been in position, which they were not, they did not have the orders to shoot down the aircraft. The best they could have done was intercept it, which meant they would be near the plane within its sight, but they didn't have the orders to do anything about it.
And, of course, with in Payne Stewart's case, the transponder was on the entire time. They knew where the plane was. What happens when you turn off the transponder? How many planes are out there? I mean, are you looking at just that one blip without the numbers next to it, or... From what I understand, it's much more complex, that it, at least on the morning of September 11th with antiquated equipment, it wasn't an easy thing to find a plane. Is that correct, Brad?
That's exactly right. There were hundreds of planes in the air that morning, and once they were able to narrow it down, it was a matter of each air traffic controller had responsibility for, I believe it was several dozen, but some of the procedures were, as you said, very antiquated, and one of the facilities, once the transponders were off, the air traffic controller had to go to another floor to follow it via radar. So the FAA was really unprepared for the circumstance that the transponders were turned off, and that certainly caused a great deal of the confusion.
Jim, I know this goes back to something that you have spoken about before, the idea that the authority should have some sort of Superman-like capability and almost an ironic investment of power and competence into the people whom the conspiracy theorists find or point to as the enemy. How does that work? And I know, Vincent, you were talking earlier about confusion that happens in the real-world situation. How does the real-world situation differ from this almost Hollywood-like view?
Well, Ben, you're absolutely right to compare it to Hollywood. I think a lot of this does come from the image of the government we see in movies, where there's always some master control center with, you know, big screens, and everybody always knows everything, you know, the instant it happens. And, of course, the real world is far more chaotic than that. And it's a classic hallmark of conspiracy theories that they tend to ascribe these superhuman powers to the groups mm-hmm. that they don't like. But I'd like to ask Vincent Dunn, as someone who spent his career as a first responder, and the public's idea that everything that the government touches, it handles with such perfect precision. You know, how does that contrast with reality, especially when you're dealing with various sorts of disasters as you do in the fire service?
Well, emergencies and disasters are actually uncontrolled events. It's an uncontrolled environment. And when police and firefighter respond and the military, we try to create some order out of this chaos. Emergency events are very chaotic. And the real world is very difficult. We stumble along and we accomplish and are successful many times. However, I believe that the public often overestimates our capabilities, the capabilities of the military and the firefighters and the police. And this is due to movies and TV programs where the emergency is always solved before the program ends.
That's true. It's always wrapped up in that even hour. I remember there are plenty of conspiracies that read something like any time a plane goes off course, it's intercepted within seconds. Brad, that's obviously wasn't the case before September 11th. The baseline is Payne Stewart. How long did it take for Payne Stewart's plane to be intercepted?
It was about an hour and 20 minutes, and that included a plane that was already up in the air. Out of Fort Elgin, I believe it was, down in Florida. Mm-hmm. So they didn't have to scramble. It was already in the air, so that would be a divert and an interception.
And, of course, this brings up another point of how some of these conspiracies work. I've read elsewhere that how could we say it was an hour and 20 minutes? This is in some of the response. It was actually it was 20 minutes. Just look at the NTSB report, or in some cases it's 15 minutes. How does that confusion come about, David, and what's the truth here?
They're confusing Eastern Daylight Time with Central Daylight Time.
And that's
there's your hour.
Right, and it's in a footnote in the report, right?
Right.
But it's interesting how often a minor mistake, you know, somebody reads that they went to intercept the plane at 9:30 and picked it up at 9:50 or what mm-hmm. thereabouts, I forget the exact times. They read that and they say, okay, they ought to be able to intercept a plane in 20 minutes. They overlook the footnote that says you're going from Eastern Standard Time to Central Time. Anybody can make a mistake like that. What makes conspiracy theories different is the mistake keeps getting repeated. We've got hundreds of letters
right
after our story came out making that point. And even after we addressed it, you still see that again and again. And anyone who's gone online has seen these lists of conspiracy theories with just that'll have, you know, 10, 20, 30 facts. And when you dig down, they all turn out to be things like that, just little mistakes. Some of them are innocent, some of them aren't so innocent, but they are endlessly repeated.
And what's amazing that I've seen is this almost an amplification effect. It's almost like feedback where you have one conspiracy theory where there are explosives in the tower, and then that magnifies into there's molten steel, which means that there was some sort of incendiary device. And then over the past year, it's developed into this thermite conspiracy, that there was thermite in the buildings. And I just saw the other day thermite with the R in a circle as if it was a trademark.
A small example of how controversy starts and how myths occur is just in the response of a fire truck. Many times we'd go to a fire, if there was an injury, someone would say, well, it took the fire department 15 minutes to get here. In the 70s, we decided to send a signal as soon as we arrived at the scenes. We give that signal 10-8. So now when somebody claims that it took us 10 minutes to get there, we show them and we can document the alarm came in at this time, and within 5 minutes we gave this signal that we were at the scene. And that protects us from all these controversies.
Because
so the perception doesn't match up to the reality in that case.
The exaggeration, you know, one person tells someone it took them 15 minutes to get there, and then the newspaper might pick that up. But now that we have the proof, we can stop the exaggerations and the myths immediately.
I think that what I've found in researching the book is that some of these perceptions that come up in the conspiracy theories arise from the source material, which often seems to be video footage on the internet or still photographs, and that's the source material. And from that sort of that flawed data, people spin these wild theories. And you put up conspiracy theorists' data, which might be watching footage on the internet and a building not coming down the way they might expect a building to come down. They've never seen one come down that way before. And then you place that against, in opposition with, say, the NIST report, which is 10,000 pages, and they tested, I think it was 236 pieces of steel in controlled laboratory conditions. And there's just a total mismatch between the data on the conspiracy side and what the experts have put together, and I think in the case of the NIST, over 3 years.
And the other thing that I think that I'm really struck by is the effort to enlist people into the cause. And you've seen this a lot with the New York Fire Department, where a variety of people, as Brad mentioned earlier, people who said that they heard an explosion, or somebody might have used the term bomb going off. And I'm interested in Vincent, in your take on how the firefighting community has responded to all these conspiracy theories, and how is this, you know, how is this movement regarded in the department? I mean, there's, you know, the dedication of New York firefighters, the loss of life that day is something that will go down in history. What's the take today on people rewriting this story or taking the events of that day and trying to put them in a political context in these conspiracy theories?
Well, we do a post-fire analysis of every major fire. So there's a post-fire analysis of the World Trade Center going on. And we want to document the true facts, because we see often the visual effects of watching the TV, that impacts the people and the audience more than the spoken word or the written word. So that's where a lot of these conspiracies take place. But we realize the importance of having a post-fire analysis and investigation, and we are doing that with the World Trade Center.
But there's no sense that there's no sense within the fire department that there was a conspiracy, or I mean, how is that regarded? When the topic of conspiracy theories come up, what's the response?
It's ridiculed. I mean, as far as it's ridiculed by most firefighters who are there, and we hear this at many fires, exaggerations and misstatements of the press. But as far as the explosions were concerned, there are many noises at a fire, many types of explosions. You can have a smoke explosion. We call it a backdraft explosion. You can have a flammable vapor left over from the kerosene fuel of the jet plane suddenly explode. You have aerosol cans that are exploding during the fire. You may have floor collapses that create a noise that sound like an explosion.
Right.
So at a fire and an emergency, we constantly hear explosions, and we investigate to find out exactly what they are.
And if just to go back to the NORAD topic just for a moment before we wrap up this section, just the concept of planes getting intercepted moments after they go off course. Here's another clip. This is when they're searching for American 77. Of course, this reinforces how difficult it was when they turned off their transponder. It was this is Boston Center talking to Washington Center. These are the two air traffic control centers.
Washington.
Okay.
let me tell you this. We were looking. We also lost American 77.
Okay, 77.
American 77.
Where was he proposed to head, sir?
Excuse me?
Where was he proposed to head, sir?
Okay, he was going to L.A. also.
He was also going to L.A.
Now,
from where, sir?
I think he was from Boston also.
Boston to L.A.
Now, let me tell you this story here. The Indianapolis Center was working this guy.
What guy?
American 77.
Okay.
At flight level 350. However, they lost radar with him. They lost contact with him. They lost everything, and they don't have any idea where he is or what happened.
So you get the sense that it was much more complicated there in the real life than, of course, it is in the conspiracy theory. We'll be right back. Stick around. We're going to be talking about where these conspiracies come from and what it means in the bigger sense in just a minute. You're listening to the Popular Mechanics Show.
We're not the conspiracy theorists on this particular issue, you know? It seems to me like, you know, 19 amateurs with box cutters taking over four commercial airliners and hitting 75% of their targets, that feels like a conspiracy theory.
Yes, that is the voice of Charlie Sheen. And yes, he has joined the ranks of the conspiracy theorists, as evidenced by his now infamous appearance on the radio show of popular conspiracy theorist Alex Jones. You're listening to a special edition of the Popular Mechanics Show. Jim, one of the most surprising things that I thought we saw in the response to the story is how quickly we were looped into the conspiracies themselves. We that day became, as you said in your afterword to the book, became official members of the neocon Zionist right wing conspiracy.
That was one of the fascinating things. You know, you'd think that everyone is invested, or almost everyone is invested in the truth. That whatever our politics, we hope that our debates are going to be more accurate, our decisions are going to be better, if at least we know what the facts are. And certainly about 9/11, of any event in our history, nothing, I can't think of one more important to really understand clearly, and if there's open questions, still to investigate them honestly. And as journalists, our job is to get the facts out there.
Right.
So it was really kind of stunning and chilling to see that within hours, literally hours of our report hitting the newsstands, that we had been just blithely lumped in with the CIA, Halliburton, Bush conspiracy in the minds of some, without any effort to really seriously consider the kind of just basic factual reporting we'd done. We had
right.
come out in favor or against any particular political viewpoint.
In fact, I think there, in many cases, it was pretty clear that people hadn't read the actual story and yet had decided that we must be part of the Bush administration's grand plan because we support what everyone saw that morning.
Well, what I've learned is that there are certain people for whom facts are just tools to make a political point. People aren't really interested in whether the facts are true or not, just if they have rhetorical value. And that's why you see this constant repetition in conspiracy circles. It doesn't really matter if it's true, if it gets the right reaction. And it's what makes the conspiracy theories relatively hard to argue against, because usually when you argue with somebody, if you can show that one of their facts is wrong, they retreat and say, oops, okay, here, let me come at it a different way.
Mm-hmm.
But in conspiracy circles, you might just get the same fact thrown back at you, and something that the internet really makes feasible today.
Yeah, it's almost an echo chamber effect. In our reporting, we were very careful not to politicize this. There is a political component to some of the anger that probably drives some of these conspiracy theories. But when you look at it, it's of course not just a radical left movement. There's also a good contingent of radical right wing support for these, isn't there? And that's kind of the scarier part.
Well, this was something that was actually, we hadn't really realized before we dug into these theories. There's no question that the conspiracy theories have been embraced in certain quadrants of the left, you know, in some anti-war marches and far-left political rallies and that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. Conspiracy books are for sale and you know, very commonplace. You know, you see it somewhat on the radio and in other areas. But what's particularly interesting is they don't all originate on the left. I mean, give you one example. In the movie Loose Change, one assumes that a lot of the people watching Loose Change are looking at it from a fairly left-wing perspective. I can't say for sure. But the movie itself quotes as an authority in a couple of cases a publication called the American Free Press. And in
right.
the film, it shows this publication sort of as if you might show a story in USA Today or the New York Times and makes various claims. What's interesting, if you go back and you look at the American Free Press, you realize it's an outgrowth of one of this country's longstanding far right-wing anti-Semitic organizations, one that at times has been involved in Holocaust denial. If you look at Rents.com, one of the biggest conspiracy websites on the net, they have a wide range of things. They say that having an article on their site doesn't constitute an endorsement, but it's interesting and chilling to see how many articles they have denying that the Holocaust happened.
Right.
So, on the one hand, 9/11 is a myth. On the other hand, Auschwitz was also a myth, according to one of the articles on this site. I wonder how many people on the far left who find these theories useful in promoting their political agenda realize that they're in bed with Holocaust deniers.
That they're actually promoting
some cases.
Yeah.
And it troubles me that, the ultra-right-wing worldview, the idea that there are black helicopters hovering and the government's been taken over by the UN and the New World Order is going to stamp out all freedom. That worldview kind of petered out after Timothy McVeigh. By the early 90s, that worldview was sort of really had gone back into the shadows. But after 9/11, it's kind of rebounded. And I have a feeling that a lot of these people on the far right who are promoting these viewpoints are thrilled that all of a sudden they have this worldwide audience and one that is often comprised of people who would consider themselves ultra-left. And in fact, at a certain point, the distinction between these two sides almost evaporates.
Right. The political spectrum becomes somewhat more of a rainbow color wheel that's looping around the back.
And for us, it's not about right or left. We're
right.
just looking at the facts. We're not intending our work to be used for one political agenda or another. We just think that whatever your viewpoint, you ought to have your facts right. And what's so striking is that people don't believe us. They think, why would you possibly want to get these facts out there unless you're on their side?
Isn't that ironic that believing a certain fact, or not believing, but just, talking about facts being things that are true or not true, that could be a political statement that such and, that gravity is a thing,
If there's anything I found a little depressing in doing this work, that's it. The idea that facts don't have intrinsic value, that the truth in itself isn't important. It's only the only facts that really matter are the facts that serve somebody's agenda. And I think that's troubling. And I think that, most of us got into journalism, I hope, to try to tell the truth. And that in itself is considered controversial in some quarters.
Well, in many ways, these theories work by coming up with a conclusion and then finding the facts to fit such conclusion. Of course, in journalism and as in science, you observe and then draw your conclusion from the observations, from whatever the facts are that you've collected. But how are these conspiracies different from, or if they are they at all different from the myriad conspiracies that haunt American history, from JFK to the Red Scare to the Salem witch hunts? I mean, it's a recurring theme.
It totally is a recurring theme. And what's interesting is not that they're different, it's how similar they are. We went back, one of the things in doing my research, I went back and read the famous essay by historian Richard Hofstadter that he published in, I believe it was 1964, and it was called The Paranoid Style in American Politics. And he was really studying the far-right McCarthy-era movement. And he quotes Joseph McCarthy in one point, talking about how our government has been taken over by a conspiracy so vast, and
right.
And that all these terrible things that have happened with the rise of communism around the world could only have happened if people inside our own government had encouraged it to happen. I mean, and some of these people at their most extreme literally thought that President Eisenhower was in the pocket of the communists. I mean, they mm-hmm. thought our government had been infiltrated to a complete extent. Well, as often happens, there were tiny grains of truth. I mean, there were some communist infiltrators. Mm-hmm. There were communists who wanted to take over the government, but they just were so far from being able to do
right.
it. And But what's interesting, if you look at a lot of the rhetoric on the conspiracy websites today, they sound just like Joe McCarthy.
Huh.
They're outraged that our government has been taken over by this cabal. They believe they're the true patriots, that someone has to do something to stop this this slide to certain ruin. They use the same hyperbolic rhetoric. And what Hofstadter says in his essay is that this is a style that's gone back in American politics through really a couple of centuries.
Mm-hmm.
At different times, there was people who were concerned that international bankers were really running the world and had started this civil war and this and that. Or the Mel Gibson, drunken statements the other day when he was arrested. This is very much in keeping, the idea that what he said, that Jews have started all the wars in history. That's been a standard talking point of a lot of these extremist movements over more than the past 100 years. And what's really stunning is to see it coming back now in the guise of 9/11 conspiracy theories, when in many ways it's not very different from concerns about the Illuminati and the Catholics and the immigrants
and the Bilderbergers and the Rothschilds and the list goes on and on. But I believe it was in your afterword where you quoted Hofstadter as saying that the paranoid, as he calls the conspiracy theorist, the paranoid, is always constantly manning the barricades of humanity against the next doomsday plot. And all these theories seem to have that same rhetoric, that this is the end of the world now.
Absolutely. And you can see how exciting it must be,
Yeah.
And I'm not talking about the person who's just interested in history and poking around the internet and comes across these and is interested and wants to learn more. Wanting to learn more is important for all of us. And I don't think we're done researching 9/11. And I certainly wouldn't encourage anybody to say it's wrong to ask questions
Right.
It's wrong to look for more information. But the real diehard conspiracy theorists, it's very empowering, I think. And this is what Hofstadter says about these movements, that people who are involved in them feel deeply energized to be one of those few brave patriots who's been able to see this terrible calamity that no one else sees. It's very telling that the word that conspiracy theorists use for all of us, all the rest of their fellow citizens here, is sheeple.
That's a new thing I've seen too, yeah.
That we're all just sheep, just somehow kowtowing to the demands of some global conspiracy,
mm-hmm.
and that we all willingly, either unknowingly, go along with it, or really they tend to think that all of us in the press are part of it.
Oh, we're the paid shills, according to that rhetoric.
Which is striking to me, because you wonder if they've ever met a reporter.
Well, yeah, exactly. And why we would be covering up what if you draw out their logic, what would be the biggest story of the century, perhaps, since the printing press?
Well, one of the things, as I was looking into this a little bit for the afterword I wrote for the book, one of the things I noticed was that in the world of conspiracies, coincidence is always seen as proof of some
right.
kind of causation. And one of the things, we saw it coming, actually, Ben, I'm going to turn the tables and ask you.
Right, right.
Ben Chertoff, when we were working this story, Michael Chertoff was not yet head of the Department of Homeland Security.
No, he was nominated 2 days before we shipped the final version of the story to the printer.
And I remember asking you at that point, hey, is there any relation? And you saying, well, maybe some, it's possible, but we really don't know.
Yeah.
But we knew that it wouldn't take that long before people would start going through the names and biographies of people who worked on the project. And so tell me what happened next.
Well, of course. Well, yeah, I got a phone call a couple of weeks later. Well, we should fast forward, because, of course, the story had to go through and become printed and then end up on the stands. I got a phone call from Christopher Bolin, who is one of the few internet conspiracy theorists who does pick up the phone and do some reporting. He asked me if we were related, and I said, I don't know, which I didn't. And the next, so that happens. I call up my parents, ask them what the relation is. I ask my dad, then I talk to my mom about it. My dad said we might be distant cousins, but if there was a relationship, it would have to go back to 19th century Belarus, where two sides, it gets almost preposterous, where the two sides of the family split, because nobody on my dad's side of the family, or nobody on any side of my family, has ever talked to Michael Chertoff. Nobody I don't know anybody in my family who's ever talked to him, and I don't think anybody in my family knows anyone who has talked to him. So, I mean, the 18th degree separation here, it gets pretty far. So anyway, I talked to my mom about that, and then Boland tracked my mom down and called her, which is impressive because she's got a different last name now, and called her, and she, of course, said, well, yeah, they might be distant cousins,
And so what do we see? About 2 days later, a story goes up online that says...
Popular Mechanics hit piece penned by, you know, Chertoff's cousin pens 9/11 hit piece. I think that's what it was.
And it's interesting to me that again, a tiny grain of truth. There might be some distant relation. You have the same name. It's possible you were related back in the old country. gets blown up. And then also, you know... With all due respect for the great work you did on this project, you weren't the author. You were one of a team of seven or eight.
Well, the best part is I got called the lead researcher, I assume because my name was first, but of course the names were in alphabetical order.
But it was one of those areas where you see a little coincidence is compounded by a lot of exaggeration, and then... Invariably today, if you go onto a message board on any site that talks about 9/11 conspiracy theories, mentions the Popular Mechanics original article, much less our book, then someone will say, well, of course, you have to know that the author of the piece was Michael Chertoff's cousin, case closed. And what makes me sort of step back and say, well, even if he was your brother, how would you have convinced me and 30 other people on the staff here to... implicate ourselves in the worst crime in American history? I mean,
yeah, no kidding. I mean, well, we must all be on the payroll, you see, which with 1.9 million federal employees has got to be, you know, it's got to be many times the size of the annual budget.
It was very striking that a very common criticism of our original article and now perhaps I'm sure of the book will be that some of the people we talked to did work for the government or had some connection to the government, like say they were consultant to the NIST report. And as if that made them immediately suspect. I even got that question on NPR one time.
Really?
The idea that, well, of course, some of the people you talked to work for the government. I said, well, aren't
well
you
don't
guys
you work for the government?
but the notion that everyone who works for the government is automatically suspect. And I'm not saying you should take everything you hear from anybody. Certainly not.
Right. But the NIST report had 125 private firms working with them, and
but the ease with which the conspiracy theorists are willing to accuse their fellow citizens of mass murder,
right.
I find really striking and chilling. And almost a certain gleefulness in assuming this conspiracy is so vast, and almost a sort of a childlike innocence that you would think that this vast group of conspirators, you know, dozens, hundreds, thousands, would all just happily go along with it, keep their mouths shut, no one would talk. I don't know any world in which that kind of scenario operates. And it makes you kind of wonder what kind of worldview that is that thinks that kind of thing is commonplace.
It's a scary thought, isn't it? Of course, 9/11 debunking the myths, or debunking 9/11 myths. Of course, I got the title of our own book wrong, is available at bookstores everywhere and barnesandnoble.com and at debunking911myths.com. Jim Meggs, thanks for joining us, and thank you to David Dunbar and to Vincent Dunn and Brad Reagan, who have since gotten tired of this and walked away.
It's great to be here. Thanks.
That's our show for this week. You can learn more about 9/11 conspiracy theories at debunking911myths.com and at popularmechanics.com. As always, we welcome your thoughts about our podcast. Please email your thoughts to popularmechanics@hearst.com. That's popularmechanics@hearst.com. Original music for this podcast was written and performed by Popular Mechanics' own Jim Ross. Our theme song is Midnight Train, written and performed by Jeremy Sherman. Many thanks to Hearst Digital Media for their help in producing this podcast. I'm your host, Ben Chertoff, reminding you to join us next week for more stories on cars, trucks, and many, many more things that go on the Popular Mechanics Show.